Welcome to another edition of The Spirit Revolution. My name is Philip Coppens.
My name is Kathleen McGowan.
And our special guest today is the return of Dr. Carmen Bulter. Welcome back, Carmen.
Hi, thanks for having me back.
Now, the reason why you are back so early, apart from the fact that you were a great guest, is also because seconds after we did the last interview with you, you dashed off to Egypt, and then you became a primary eyewitness into some of the going-ons to do with 11-11-11. After the events in January, and Twitter just announced that the two things which headlined 2011 on its website, social network site, is Charlie Sheen and the Egypt Revolution of January 25th, 2011. Now, we all thought that in the past year progress had been made when it came to antiquities. We thought that the demise of, as I like to refer to him now, the late Zahi Hawass, not necessarily because he's dead, but because he seems to have been gone for good now from the scene, was something which was going to bring about a new change in the way Egypt was going to deal with its antiquities. Now, apart from what happened at 11-11-11, the only thing I have heard from the Egyptian Antiquities Department is that they are very much behind because of what was happening this year, and that so nothing new is being done excavation-wise, but also that it seems to be quite business as usual, that nothing really has changed. Now, you were involved, you were there for a number of weeks. First of all, let's start with 11-11-11. Can you just briefly explain what you went to do and what happened?
Okay, well, we got a permit that was going to allow us to go into the Great Pyramid and 2 hours between the paws of the Sphinx. And somewhere within the time after we had the permit, they said there were so many groups that wanted to go that they had advanced our time to 1:30 in the morning, which is the wee hours of 11-11. And at first we thought we were just going to get the permit for the Great Pyramid, but that they had changed it. They were going to give us an hour in the Great Pyramid and 2 hours between the paws of the Sphinx. So on the afternoon of the 10th, since it was just in the wee hours of the 11th, we got confirmation of our permit. And then we were conducting the tour for the day, and we were on the bus on our way to Abu Sir, and a phone call came through. And it happened that the logistics person for the tour company was on the bus, and she came and she said, I need to speak to you in private. And she said, the military has decided to close the Great Pyramid for 24 hours for 11-11. Prior to that, she had said, no one should wear a Star of David into the Great Pyramid. I went, okay, no problem. And she said, make sure no one has a pendant that has a Star of David. And there's been rumors that have been announced in the newspaper that there was some kind of Zionist plot that was going on, and that they were afraid of rituals going on in the Great Pyramid that would, quote unquote, steal the pyramid from the people. All of which were turns of phrases that were a little confusing. And what I learned is that there had been a meeting with the military, and that there were 20 groups who had gotten permits to go into the Great Pyramid. And there were also permits for the second pyramid and the third pyramid, but the only one that they were concerned about was the Great Pyramid. And so from 1 minute to the next, they slammed it shut. They told us our permits had been canceled. And then they offered whether we wanted to go another day or if we wanted our money back, because you pay for these permits. And so I suggested that we go on the 20th. Of November, which is when we came back from Luxor and Aswan. And I had to break it to the group. And people flew straight into their egos. Oh, I paid for this and da, da, da. And I kept saying, well, how do you know that it won't be better? What we do won't be better because there's other things we can do. And for me, though, I wasn't the least bit disappointed because when I first got to Egypt, I could feel the energy, which is probably something I can speak to you about under another question. But
absolutely.
I just smiled and said, well, you can't shut the energy down. You want to lock the door of the pyramid? Go ahead.
First of all, I want to commend you for how incredibly calm you were about it. And I don't know if you were this calm when it was happening. Were you this calm when it was happening?
Absolutely. Honest to God, because of the energy, which perhaps we want to back up and start again on how that went. And the other thing is that this young woman who was the logistics coordinator, she started to cry because she was going to come with us. And my thought was, okay, you do the crying and I'll do the regrouping. And I, honest to God, I was as calm as could be. Everybody came, not everybody, but a lot of people came to yell at me and to tell me how disappointed they were. And I just looked them straight in the eye and said, you don't know what's going to happen. It could be fine.
Absolutely. And Philip and I, having led spiritual journeys, you know, we were, as you were telling the story, we were sort of laughing at with each other about this idea of what happens when you have to break the news to a group that something is not going to go as planned. So what I would like to do is let's back up. Let's go back to what the energy was like when you arrived. And I also want to know a little bit more about what were you expecting? What was the overall theme of what you were doing with this group? What were your plans? What is it that they were expecting, that they wanted to have happen? How was the energy when you got there? Let's talk about the spiritual aspects of it a little bit, and then we'll get more into the logistics of the story.
Okay. A while back, I decided I was going to do three groups if the politics would allow for it. 10-10-10, October 10th, 2010, which happened, 11-11-11, and 12-12-12. But one at a time to see what would happen. And it's interesting that I planned it that way because this was my 26th trip. And I've never said if it's okay. And I didn't know the revolution was going to happen. And so at 10-10-10, there was something different about what was going on in Egypt. And I felt that the people who were working with us that were Egyptian were distraught and distracted. I couldn't figure out why, because I had been there a number of times. And so when I got back and in January things started to the revolution started, I just instantly went, that's it. On some level, the thing was brewing on Facebook. People knew that that the situation had reached impossible levels and that the populace just couldn't take it anymore, because basically the thing is they didn't have the money to buy food, to buy bread, to buy flour. And, you know, the price of bread had doubled and cooking oil and everything and doubled again. But the value of the Egyptian pound had gone to half the value it had been. So for years and years, it was 3.14 Egyptian pounds to the American dollar. And now it's 6 point something. So literally, the value has gone in half. So because of the 26 trips, there's always been someone since 1977 who said, oh, no, you can't go to Egypt because it's dangerous. And haven't you watched CNN and you must be afraid? And then I would get to Egypt and think, yippee, you know, there's absolutely nothing to be afraid of here. It's far more dangerous in the United States than it is anywhere else on the planet that I've been. And I've been to 52 countries and Egypt counts as one. And so I've learned to kind of see through this, though if there's enough CNN fear, it makes you question what's going on. So I had talked to my people on the ground there who I've known for a number of years, 16 years. And so I went in there with confidence. I did get a number of phone calls before we went, particularly, interestingly, on October 10th. And I was thinking when all these people were phoning me, why is 10-10? Oh, because that's the last time we were in the Great Pyramid. So I thought, well, okay, that's just curious. Anyway, so I told everybody, I don't care, I'm going. I have confidence. The Egyptian people need us. I'm absolutely confident they're going to greet us with great joy and pleasure that we're there and that everything's fine. I just know it. And so when I landed at the airport, I looked around and I thought, this is the first time I've been in the airport in Egypt where I don't see a single gunman, nobody standing there with a machine gun, no police, nothing. And I thought, if this is the only result of the revolution, hallelujah. Because for the first time, my family was coming on the group. I had two sisters and a cousin. And I thought, well, the longer they can go and have an airport look normal, the better. So we made it all the way through, all the way to the hotel. I went to my room. I greeted people who were there already. And then I said to one of them, I haven't seen a gun since I got here. This is amazing. And just at the moment I said that, here came a tourist police and he had a little handgun, but no machine guns or anything. And even on the entrances to the Giza Plateau, there usually were these booths with shields and gunmen and trucks and the police, gone. absolutely gone. So I thought, well, this is a real step in the right direction. There was never anything to be afraid of anyway. They've had no incidents. And this military presence was like hugely, hugely over the top and unnecessary. So I looked out at the pyramid and I thought, oh my God, the energy is so strong. Now, I've spent a lot of time inside the body of the Sphinx and doing things on the plateau, in the tunnels, in the pyramid, by myself, hours and hours and hours. And there was something particularly curious about being inside the body of the Sphinx. And whenever I did that, I wouldn't sleep for 72 hours. And I could feel, I called it space between my cells and the substance that psychicness is made of. That's how I defined my feeling. And it literally is a vibration. And I thought, well, this is as strong as being inside the Sphinx. So the energy itself, you know, had magnified to the point where we were happened to be at the Meridian Hotel. And it's within view of the pyramids. You're literally in the shadow of the pyramids. It's right across from Mena House, which is the closest hotel to the Giza Plateau. And so I was so impressed with the energy, and I went straight into not being able to sleep and being able to just go into a meditative state and feel completely refreshed. And so the idea of the 10-10-10, 11-11-11, and 12-12-12 was that they are ascension portals. But particularly 11-11 is a gateway into a multidimensional reality, if you will. And that's difficult to define. But last time when we were in the Great Pyramid on 10-10-10, the time before, we brought some measurement instruments that were measuring the photonic emissions off the human aura. And we did a pretest before we went into the Great Pyramid. We measured everyone twice, looking at the emotional physical body and the spiritual body. And then we did a delayed post-test where we measured everyone again. And there were 43 people, I think, in this group. And my hypothesis was that once someone had been imprinted in the Great Pyramid, the energy would stay with them. So even though they were outside the field of the Great Pyramid, that they would retain some of this enhanced energy, if you will, a more refined energy. Now, it's been my experience going, you know, I lived in Egypt. I spent months at a time going in and out of the pyramid, and I really have spent a good deal of time there. And my experience has been that the more time that I've spent in those energy fields, the more psychic I've become. And that's difficult to describe, which is why having measurement instruments would assist that. We were also measuring the energy fields within the pyramid to correlate them with the effect on the human aura, which I think is an interesting measure as well. So the idea, going into the Great Pyramid, I don't want to be prescriptive and tell people what to think or pray necessarily in a certain way. The idea, as I said, we were like making a collective basket, a woven basket to catch energy, that we were like giant receptors, and that in our silence or in light toning in the Great Pyramid, that we would create a unified field, and then we were to absorb the energy and allow it to process. Because sometimes it takes weeks, months, hours at least, to register at the cellular level what this energy is. But I'm absolutely certain, having experienced the 10-10 and the 11-11, that the energy is augmenting.
So you were there, this is all happening. First of all, going back to something very early, this Masonic conspiracy, I remember that they canceled the 31st of December 1999 to the eve of the new millennium celebration as well, because they didn't want to put a capstone on the Great Pyramid because it was seen as a Masonic plot. Definitely when it was being read about what was happening on 11-11-11, it looked very much as if, to some extent, there was, and please confirm or deny what I'm going to say here, but it almost looked as if there was a rumor going around, and they needed to make it sound as if it was once again Masons and Israelis who were opposing Egypt, and that they had to rally the Egyptian people to a cause, and that, you know, Masonry and Star of David is the easiest way of doing that. But is it just something which is ill understood? Is it just something which happens there? Or do you think there is more to it than that? Do you think that there are people in Egypt who really know what's happening, who really understood that 11/11/11 might be very important, and that they just want to stop this in its tracks?
Good question to ask me, because I also had a group for the millennium shift. And I also had a place then. A friend of mine built me a place called the Hall of Records Retreat Center, which happened to be adjacent to the third pyramid. And we had a rooftop, and literally the plateau was in the palm of our hands. And so before the group arrived, I watched them build the bleachers for the event. And as you know, there was a worldwide event as it turned to the year 2000 in New Zealand and Australia, and then it wrapped its way around the globe hour by hour. And the world was waiting to see the show that had been prepared for Egypt. Now, concurrent to this was the idea of a placement of the capstone on the top of the Great Pyramid. And that's something that I questioned, because the top of the Great Pyramid, I've been up there twice, is not flat. And in order to put a capstone up there, I mean, what kind of a crane would go up 383 feet? How would you shape the thing, because it's not flat? There is a wooden tripod up there, and at the end of the Second World War, they actually had three different flags that they flew up there, and they never took that down, and they still hadn't taken it down. On December 30th or December 31st, there was no equipment anywhere, and they kept promising it and promising it. The other thing that was promised was that the Rosetta Stone would come back, the original one, from the British Museum to have its rightful place in the National Museum. And the replica was going to be replaced. And apparently Robert Bovall, who was just in my Evolver Intensives course a week ago, was in charge of this flight. And I was in touch with him and waiting for this to happen. So back to the preparations, they laid some 20 miles of electrical cable on the Giza Plateau, and they put up bleachers to the south of the Second Pyramid, and they had a famous singer whose name escapes me at the moment, and they were preparing to have a sound and light show that was using the south face of the Second Pyramid as a screen. And so in the privileged position on the fourth floor roof of the Hall of Records Retreat Center, I sat there for days and watched them get this ready. And I thought, that's an awful lot of electricity. I watched them rehearse. I saw them put the bleachers up. And then it seemed that there was very, very low enrollment and registration reservations at the hotels. They were sitting at 23%. And I thought, well, who are all these people who are going to pay? I think it was something like $900 US per ticket. But I watched them put the bleachers up. I watched them put all this equipment together, and I listened to them do the rehearsal. I saw the slideshow on the Second Pyramid, and I thought, okay, now I have to admit that I thought that this is counter to the magnetic energy, that if you put electrostatic energy into the field, it's directly opposed to the passive magnetic field. And I thought, well, if there's any plot here, having all this electricity is really going to ruin the energy. And I was very concerned about this. And so on the morning of the 31st of December, there was an article in the newspaper that said, Zionist plot, as you described, Philip, not putting the capstone on because it's probably going to turn things on and it's going to ruin everything and whatever. I mean, the story doesn't really add up. Like and I've read, you know, the detailed words of how they presented that, as well as how they presented shutting down at 11/11. Anyway, so the group arrived, and we've got our New Year's Eve accoutrements, and we're all sitting there waiting. And all of a sudden, in the afternoon, it started to rain. Now, I've spent a lot of time in Egypt. Rain is not common, and fog is even less common. And so it rained and rained and rained to the point where there were puddles running down the street in the village where the center was. And then fog started that was so thick that it was in front of the second pyramid, and the whole pyramid was engulfed, and these electric wires were soggy, and they were covered in water. So none of what they had planned could happen. Nobody could sit in the bleachers because it was pouring with rain. And so it came and went that midnight happened, and it was the year 2000, and everybody went to bed. And I sat there, and I watched this fog approach and get thicker and thicker and thicker until it was literally right on the edge of the roof of the patio that I was sitting on. And I sat there till like 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning with my mouth hanging open. And then, of course, all the emails were coming. What happened? What happened? Egypt was blacked out. There was nothing. Well, I thought, how is it that the moisture and the magnetic energy would, like, because, you know, you get negative ions in the rain, would have come to counter the static energy? I thought it was a miracle. I mean, I didn't care if it was shown on TV. So to me, there was a counter force operating, and I felt totally blessed by that. So it was similar to the incredible palpable energy this time, and having them shut down the pyramid. It's like, okay, cancel the show. Okay, lock the pyramid. I couldn't care less.
I mean, that's an extraordinary thing. So in retrospect, the Millennium Eve, it went not right. 10-10-10 seems to have gone great. 11-11-11, there seems to have been human intervention in keeping these things out. I'm going to kind of repeat the question because it's like the second part, which is, do you think that what was happening this year was somehow that people know, or was it just the upheavals are still there? Because shortly afterwards, there was once again people taking to Tahrir Square in demanding that the military basically allow more democracy and less control. Is there a correlation between these events? Is there something larger going on whereby, you know, New Egypt still has birthing problems? Or what is the deal in Egypt?
And my, just the second piece of the question is this whole idea of Zionist plot just sort of the tag they put on anything to give them an excuse to do whatever they want? If they can just say Zionist plot, then they kind of have carte blanche to do anything that they see fit.
Yes, I'm going to say yes to that, Kathleen. Now, the Egyptian people are not involved in the museum, in the artifacts, in the story of ancient Egypt. If the pyramids disappeared, I don't think anybody would care. Really, it's not their culture. They're concerned about their families, education for their children, making ends meet. The talking to people on the ground about the revolution that happened on the 25th and continued was the most touching thing. The bus driver, the transfer agent, the people, if you ask them how they did, it was incredible. But they kept saying, the revolution is not complete, because now we've got Mubarak out, which is stage one. And 31 of the ministers are under house arrest or in jail, definitely taken away and not in circulation. I don't think they're in jail the way an ordinary person would be. They have certain privilege, but they have also, they're not allowed to walk around. So people felt very satisfied that they had had some kind of an influence. So the idea that it was incomplete has been hovering. Now, the military had the rule. The military are who shut things down. It isn't business as usual. However, the United States still gives $2 billion a year to the military in Egypt. And one of the things that they were doing is using all this pepper spray, and there was 7,000 tons more of pepper spray being delivered from the United States with the intent of what? Spraying it in the people's faces. And then there was some, I want to say, lame attempt to say, oh, well, if you're going to be spraying it at the people, maybe we won't send it. But they sent it anyway. And so there's many levels going on here. But what's true is the military needed to step down. It's the next stage. And they were becoming a little bit brutal. And anyway, so I think it's two completely separate things. I think that the Zionist plot is their carte blanche excuse. I think that it was clear to everybody that if they just didn't go back to Tahrir Square, that the military would just keep ruling and the election may not have even happened. The incident that happened at the end of the trip, we were sitting in Aswan with a 180-degree view of the Nile, absolutely on the top of our game. Everybody was delighted with how everything had gone. Our accommodations were spectacular. And then somebody went online and went, oh, the revolution's happening again in Cairo. But it was isolated to a city block. It was contained in a way that they didn't even have to close the National Museum, which is right bordering on that block. And the people were like our transfer agent was like, I'm not even watching TV. Like, CNN, television just makes this look so much worse than it is. And everybody was just doing their life. Nobody even blinked that this was happening. It did not bleed all over everything. But meanwhile, I was getting all these emails from people, have you got bullets through you? I mean, imagining that the entire group was sitting on Tahrir Square, you know, and it's just not the way it is. Meanwhile, as I probably mentioned before, there were protests in 1,500 cities, you know, so they're making Egypt look like it's the most terrible, most dangerous place when there's danger going on all over the world. So it really is taken out of context and they repeat. And I only know this because I spent two nights in Europe on the way back and it was me and the television because I missed a flight. And so I did watch CNN and BBC and I watched them repeat from this angle, using the same footage. They don't have that much. And it's true that they have to keep protesting in order for the military to back down, in order for the election to happen. So it seems to me that these other stages of the revolution are predictable, and it's the way you change things. And the people are happy. So the way CNN spins it, I mean, they're not telling the human interest stories that are so incredibly touching, where people didn't have feed for their horses because everything shut down, and then truckloads would come from wealthy people to feed everybody's horses, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Mubarak led all the people out of jail, and they had no money, no clothes, no vehicles, and the people protected their own villages, looking in each car. People were so proud of the fact that they could protect themselves. And CNN doesn't care about human interest stories or about people becoming empowered. So what we need to do is really consider the spin. And I'm going to add one more point. Because of jet lag, I was getting up early, going to sit in the dining room of the Meridian Hotel. There's about 150 seats in here. And I looked out my eyes and I didn't see a single Westerner. I saw scads of people from India, China, Taiwan, all over Asia, all over South America. Nobody from Australia, North America, England, and the only conclusion is these other countries aren't watching, you know, 60 times an hour, danger, 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 and we are. So our group was amongst, you know, not very many Western people anywhere, but that didn't mean Egypt wasn't full. That doesn't mean that the secrets of Egypt aren't interesting to people in the rest of the world. It means people are buying into the propaganda. And to me, that is as clear as day.
Absolutely. And there is definitely, I think, in the West, not just to Egypt, but the entire Middle East, this idea that we have to depict it as the most unsafe ground in the universe, that, you know, you will die simply as soon as you get out of the plane. And Egypt is one of the safest countries in the world. It has one of the lowest crime rates ever. And it is a beautiful country. Now, going back to all of these time periods, 10-10, 11-11-11, the next one you're doing is 12-12-12. We are coming close to the one-year date of December 21st, 2012. We are living in changing times. We call the show the Spirit Revolution. You were clearly moved to do things with these specific dates of 11-11-11 and 12-12-12. What do you see happening? Do you see this is something which isn't associated with the Mayan calendar? Do you see something else is happening? Why are you doing it right now? And as you say, you definitely feel something is happening. So is this something which is happening to a larger cosmic clock, so to speak? Or is it just something which is happening through things which are being stirred up through mankind and its doings itself?
No, the cosmic clock, it's something I may have mentioned last time, that I've done a lot of work in Starry Night Pro to actually look at what will happen on December 21st at sunset, Giza, at the Great Pyramid. And there is an exact alignment with our sun in the center of the galaxy. Now, the entirety of the Band of Peace that I discuss in the Pyramid Code is a map of the star systems that are aligned to the extragalactic meridian, which is not the solar system. It's outside the galaxy. And Sirius is the center of the extragalactic grid, which speaks to the idea, as Walter Cruttenden has introduced, that we are in a binary star system with the planet, with Sirius. And it's true that one of the shafts in the Great Pyramid always points to Sirius. And that's very confusing to people. But it's so, if you're aligning on the extragalactic grid, it makes sense. So if you go from Sirius, which is Abu Roush, and Orion, which is the Giza Plateau, and then move along to Abu Sir, which is the Pleiades, and keep going to Dashur, and I haven't identified what Saqqara is, which is in the middle there, which is Cygnus, the spinal cord of the bird of Cygnus, and you keep going, you go straight into the galactic center. And so there's absolutely no dispute. And it's not 11:11 in New York. It is sunset Giza, December 21st, 2012. Now, my conviction was that we needed to be outside for that part, not inside the Great Pyramid. And so that's going to be the buzz day, and the likelihood that they close it for the Zionist plot is high. Now, asking for 12-12-12 was in keeping with this numerological sequence. And I don't know if they'll close it or not, but we do have a booking and a permit for 12-12. And again, if they want to close it, you know, usually when you ask for permits, you have to wait for weeks, you have to pay money, you have to be registered, you have to be approved. And so when they canceled us, they just gave us a new date last time. And so if they try to prevent us from doing it again, let them. Because there's plenty of places along the Band of Peace where we can go. And like I said, on 11-11, we ended up going in the Red Pyramid at Dashur. And to me, the entirety of the Band of Peace is a unified field, and increasingly so as the energy continues. So actually, between you and me, when I got the 10-10-10, 11-11-11, 12-12-12, I didn't even know why. But Spirit told me. And so I decided to book it. I thought, well, I've been following what Spirit tells me for long enough. I'll find out later why. And then people started talking to about these dates being ascension portals and numerological sequences. But there are many numerological sequences and planetary alignments. And, you know, I went for 12-12. There was a trip in, it was December 12th, 1994, and it was demarcating when Pluto moved from Scorpio into Sagittarius. And they made a 12-12 group. And so because I was a participant in that group with 268 people all the way back in 94, I thought, I want to do 12-12 again. And so, you know, maybe it wasn't particularly deep when I started, other than the fact that I tend to go to Egypt once a year with a group. And that made sense to me to make that plan. But since I made that plan, it's become increasingly significant. And so to continue with that sequence, the plan would be to be in the Great Pyramid on 12-12. Whether they allowed us or not, we did something else that, as I said, was even better. And I mean it. And so they let us in the Great Pyramid another day, or they don't. It's still worthwhile going.
So going back to this most recent group, did you go back into the Great Pyramid on 11-20 as they had offered?
Yes.
And how did that go?
Well, it was completely profound. And when the inspector came along with his little beret, when we came out, actually, he was looking at his ticket, the permit. And he said, oh, look, it's 2011-2011. And I laughed and said, well, you want numerology? That's pretty good numerology, if you ask me. And so we had people from six countries. There were 35 of us in the group, and other people joined us. So there were 40 of us in the pyramid. At first, they were only going to leave the King's Chamber open. They said we couldn't bring our cameras in. I had already left my camera on the seat of the bus because I wanted to have an experience, not do a photo shoot. And I said, how about opening all three chambers? He said, okay. So off we went into the Great Pyramid, and I had made a very clear request to the group. We go in there, we settle all three. If the chambers are open, you know, anybody can go to whichever chamber they want and then stop, because every footstep goes do through the pyramid. And I thought it was really important that we move and settle and then feel the energy. And because it's a resonance chamber, I think vowel sounds of toning is very instructive. So people were getting in and out of the sarcophagus, people were in the queen's chamber, people were in the pit, and halfway through the hour that we had, we switched. So there was thunderous footsteps for a few moments, and then we were able to just imprint the energy of the Great Pyramid. It was absolutely spectacular energy. It was very profound, very alive. And people who were in the sarcophagus in the King's Chamber said they reached a point of resonance. So there was something about the tone and then all three chambers resonating at the same time that created a particular energy field within the sarcophagus. And so, you know, people kind of wobbled out of there because the energy actually affects us on the physical level. We poured into the bus and drove a few feet and went down to the Sphinx, at which point we were allowed to take our cameras. So we were in the Great Pyramid between 4 and 5 o'clock, and then from 5 to 7 we had in the Sphinx. Now, I had prepped some of the people explaining some of the chambers that are around the Sphinx that, of course, you're not allowed to get in. And I wasn't sure if we could or we couldn't. But because of what I've done before, I know that sometimes you can make yourself invisible and sneak in, but the hard part's to get out, because if they're distracted when you get in and you're kind of, you know, eyes wide when you come out, sometimes it's a little harder to sneak around. Anyway, I didn't know what they were going to be able to do. And I selected three women who I thought should go into the inner chamber of the heart of the Sphinx. So behind, if you're facing the Sphinx, there's the large stela that was put there by Thutmose the IV. And if you go up behind it, there's actually a trap door. And there's a chamber that's actually inside the heart of the Sphinx. And that's a spectacular place to sit, even above the chamber, because the head of the Sphinx is just right above you. It's really quite neat. And again, if you are the body of the Sphinx, the left rump has a passageway. Now, there were many passageways inside the Sphinx, and I've been very interested in this for 30 years, but the most recent restoration covered many of them and left just a few. And the passageways that are, you know, connect to the honeycomb of underground passageways around the entirety of the Giza Plateau and the entirety of the Band of Peace have been blocked over thousands of years, but in different ways. And so they had put a grating over the left rump, back paw of the Sphinx. And miraculously, it was open. And so I had selected and prepped one gentleman from Australia to go in there, and we were allowed to take pictures. The inspector from the Supreme Council of Antiquities with his beret was apparently oblivious to these other things. And I had kind of programmed that, you know, he'd kind of not notice. And perhaps this is part of the New Egypt with less restrictions. And so I have a full documentation of what's inside through this passageway. And it's three stories. And when I had last been in there, like, they've tampered with it quite a bit. There's wood in there. It was a hanging ladder with one half of it falling off when I was in there. And to me, it was these spiral wormhole passageways that just sent me spinning into other dimensional frequencies. And as I mentioned, after being in there, I couldn't sleep for 72 hours. That's 3 days and nights. And so I sent this young man down in there, and he photographed it, and I have a complete record of that. And then on the other side, if you are the Sphinx, on the right front paw by the elbow, there's another 14-foot kind of square that sticks out. And if, you know, you can see that easily, if it's large. And what's inside there, it's the only place where there's no restoration on the real body of the Sphinx, which means that it's almost like sand. So it's almost like taking a sand castle and putting bricks around it or cement around it, and then the sand would crumble, but the sand then crumbles inside this casing. So it's almost like putting the Sphinx inside this huge plastic bucket, if you will. And so quite a few people got in there. Three women and then three men individually went into the inner chamber of the heart of the Sphinx. And we were all the way around in every chamber that's accessible in the Sphinx, between the paws, at the little altar, in front of and behind the stela. And then I came out at 7 o'clock like a quote-unquote good girl, because that was the time that we had. And the sound and light show was going to start. And the inspector let us sit there with our cameras and take pictures, even though there's a danger that the light from the sound and light show will project our shadows right onto the Sphinx. And he allowed us to sit there and take photographs of the Sphinx, all different colors and all of that. And that didn't last long, and it didn't have to, because I've heard the sound and light show probably 2,500 times or more, maybe 3,000. And Hakim, who's in the Pyramid Code in his life starting in whatever it started, had heard it over 60,000 times. And it's the wrong story. I mean, they're basically, you know, whatever, I don't need to go into that. But the way that they promote Egyptology isn't the whole story. But, I mean, what a privilege. And it ended up being the last night of our group. So we got back on the bus. Everybody was just absolutely delighted. I mean, did I have to ask them if they cared that we did that a different day? No. And I still haven't told you what we did do on 11/11. And so we got on the bus, and I, you know, had to read the list of the airport transfers, and everybody went and freshened up, and we had dinner, and poof, the group was over. And so there was something about keeping it the best till the end, and it worked beautifully. It was fantastic. And yes, I think it's the new Egypt.
Well, my most important question is, when do we leave? Because I want to go with you.
December 8th to, it's either the 7th, the 8th to the 7th or the 8th to the 22nd.
Wow.
Is the next trip. And all the details are posted on my website, pyramidcode.com.
Okay, that's what I was going to ask you. So this is open to the public. So if any of our listeners are listening to this and they want to do this, they can go to your website and they can contact you, correct?
That's right. And I've booked for a big group. This will be the biggest group I ever take. I already have 27 people and counting.
And what would you say to people who think, wow, I would really love to be there on December 21st at sunset, but I'm a little bit afraid? What would you say? Because that's me, by the way. What would you say to that?
Well, I wouldn't say this to you, but I'll say this to them. Don't come then. Just don't do it if you're afraid.
And but, by the way, I love Egypt, and I agree that I think Egypt is possibly the safest place I've ever been. I have never felt more comfortable, more safe, more sort of embraced by spirit than in Egypt. So I actually have no fears about being in Egypt for any of those traditional reasons. It's just the whole, I'm still very much in that place of, where do I want to be on December 21st?
But exactly.
But when I listen to you, I'm so captivated by everything that you're saying about what's going to happen in that place at sunset. It just feels like energetically it could be the most magical place in the world to be.
And it was the most magical place on 11/11 and on 10/10. I am telling you, I've got a lot of experience with the energy by myself. And now it seems that I'm able to give this gift is offered to other people. And so I have to say, before the group came, I was interviewed for a movie on 11/11 at Mena House. And then the crew and I and this other woman who had been on the 10/10 group, we all went out to dinner. And I said, I'd like to propose a toast. And they said, oh, great. So everybody lifted their glass. And I said, here's to all the people who are too scared to come to Egypt, who are sitting on their couches. Cheers.
So you didn't tell us what you did do on 11/11, and I would very much like to hear that, because I have a feeling it's quite a story.
It is. You know, and the precursor to it was, there was two people who actually took a taxi back instead, and they weren't on the bus when I announced it. And so they were hearing all the rumors, and people were so stunned that we couldn't go, that everybody heard something different. And so, you know, I was like, well, come on, it's Egypt. Just give me a minute here and let me, you know, like, cause we had not booked to go to Abu Ghraib because ever since the pyramid code came out, they want $1,100 for anybody to go there, for a group to go. And Abu Ghraib is where the quartz crystal altar is. And it's not a pyramid there. It's the base of the largest, obelisk that ever was. And that's where the round discs that are shaped like satellite dishes are. And it is one of the most sacred, amazing places with the highest level technology. And I'm telling you, we're talking about like 3.5 feet high, a six foot disc in the center, and this huge, huge array of quartz crystal. Now, if you read about it, they'll tell you that it's alabaster. And, the other thing is it's called Abu Ghraib, which sounds like the prison, right? And so, I mean, obviously somebody understands that you can take words and take the most sacred place and turn it into the most dastardly place by using the same name. Anyway, so Hakim's son appeared out of nowhere when we were at Abu Sir, which is a related site. There's six different sites on the Band of Peace, pyramid sites that go north to south. And so he's like, you want to get in there? We can get in there. Not only that, it was full moon. The Great Pyramid is like a sauna, right? It's stuffy. It's, you know, it's energetically tuned and everything, but there's nothing like being outside. And every time I've been to the quartz crystal altar, it's the blazing sun that just bakes you, right? And so we each would lie on the altar and get the energy from that, but, and tone and that sort of thing. But the energy anywhere on the Band of Peace during the day is nothing like, it's the static, heated, overheated energy, not like the magnetic energy. And so I really felt like Hakim was with us. The lady from the logistics from the tour company was like, no, no, you can't do that. You can't go anywhere. We can't take the bus. I'm like, okay, well, we're not going to do anything. So kind of just, you know, kind of be quiet because, I mean, I've done lots of things that you're not supposed to do, but why not? And sorry, I'm a bit of a rebel when it comes to Egypt. But anyway, in any case. And so Joseph said, I can get you taxis. How many taxis do you need for 35 people? I said, 11. Okay, so he went and found, you know, 11 taxi drivers, and I went to the village, and we had the whole thing set up, and he knows the watchmen that are up there, and you have to pay, and 11 taxis appeared, and everybody came out of the hotel, and they were all there, and we got in the taxis, and off we went, and we didn't want to attract attention to ourselves, so if you are in the Watch the Pyramid Code, you'll know that Hakim was born in the village of Abu Sir. He's an indigenous wisdom keeper who has passed, but that doesn't mean he's gone, for sure. And so we were able to park the 11 taxis in the garden of his uncle's home that is right on the edge where Abu Sir is. And we went along the wall that, you know, they put in a huge wall at least 20 miles all the way around. This is Zahi's work, Zahi Hawass, the late Zahi Hawass, as Philip says. And so we had to walk a great long distance along the wall and then through an opening because they have to have openings. And then up in the full moonlight, 35 people walking up a sand dune in silence. And then we had as much time as we wanted. We paid the taxi drivers to wait. And we were able to be on the entire site of Abu Ghraib with all this quartz in the full moonlight for 2.5 hours. It was warm. It was magical. It was so bright, and the moon was interacting with the crystal. And I thought, this is heaven. Well, and speaking of which, there was a woman who was a harpist who brought a miniature harp, not that small, but certainly not the size of a, you know, 6 feet tall, like a usual harp. And she sat off in the distance and played the harp while people got on the 6 foot circle one by one. And I went over to her at the end and I looked at her and I said, are we in heaven? And she kept playing and just smiled like a little cherub with wings. And the woman sitting next to me said, I think so. So was that better or worse? So then we went back and everybody went to sleep. Well, actually, we were so energized when we came back. And because people have early flights and stuff, breakfast at the Meridian starts at 3:30. So when we came back, we all went to breakfast and were laughing and everybody was almost giddy, like you know, what do you call that, punch happy or whatever. We were just like energized beyond, absolutely energized beyond. And then we had most of the day with a 2:30 departure to go into the Red Pyramid. And then it was the whole day of 11:11. There were a few people who were invited by an archaeoastronomer. There were six people, spaces, to be inside the third pyramid on 11:11:11 at 11:11. And so we had to decide who those six people were. And I said, the six people who are the most upset, whoever can throw the best temper tantrum gets to go. And so there were people like, oh, it's my birthday and I need to be there. And I'm like, okay, you're one of those six people. And they were exhausted. Everybody else got to sleep and have bubble baths and all that stuff. And then we got to be alone in the Red Pyramid, which is almost as big as the Great Pyramid with acoustic chambers. And so it's like we had a marvelous day. We had a marvelous night. It was fantastic.
It sounds absolutely magical, and it also sounds like everything happened exactly the way that it was supposed to happen. Mm-hmm. And my question is, did the group really ultimately get that? The people who were originally upset and went into ego and all those things when you first had to tell them the plans were changing. By the end of the experience, I would imagine that everybody, or almost everybody, truly understood that there was a spiritual method to this madness.
You got it. And the other thing, too, is that when I had to go to check about the taxis and stuff, there were a couple of people who were around me going, she has to go. Like, you may think it's just magic that we're going to just have 11 taxis appear, but I got to go do it. I got to go make it happen, right? And there were people who wanted to yell at me instead of let me go. And there were a couple of people who just kept looking at the ones who wanted to yell and said, you know, we know you're upset, but she's going to fix this if you let her fix it, right? And so... And I just stood there. I was completely neutral. You need to yell at me? Okay. You know, if I'm free, I'm going to go. Like, I knew I'd be up all night anyway. And one by one, after, they came and they looked me in the eye and gave me a hug and thanked me. But what was interesting is at the very end, this one woman, and I'm afraid I have to call her a Southern Belle, she came up to me and she said, what a great trip. And it was, you led the group so well and everything, except for the few meltdowns you had. And I'm like, meltdown, which meltdown? Did I say anything to her, you know? And that, no, it was her meltdown when she screamed at me about the 11:11, right? That then became my meltdown. So then she didn't have to be a person who melted down because she totally projected her onto me. But, you know, I'm a real sensitive person and, you know, like over the years, like I used to take people's stuff on and wonder what I could do to make it better. But this time, I mean, my liberation was that it was so clear to me that this was their stuff. It wasn't even them. It was their ego. They go funny in the eyes. They can't look you right in the eye and they're, I have rights and you better get your money back. And well, actually it's your money. And if I get the money back, then we can't go another day. It's like, it became this whole, sorry, but American, I'm entitled thing.
Right.
And then all of a sudden people kind of melted and went, oh, there's nothing to that. That's just empty. So yes, they came upon it one by one, you know, but nobody said, how did you get 11 taxis and how'd you get them to let you do it?
Right.
Or ask how much it cost me, because just that cost me like $850. But people were just like, oh, it's magic. You know, it's like, well, it's actually also practical, and we also had to be safe. Like, well, how come we had to park in this garden? Well, because we were actually not supposed to be doing this. You know what I mean? Like, people become clueless, and they just, you know, end up with these expectations. So I think, you know, because of the quiet way that I handled it, one by one, people just woke up on their own.
And isn't that the key message, I think, that whenever people are really coming to touching distance of transformation or initiation or whatever word you want to call it, there is two reactions. One of them is to go through it. And the other people, it's where the ego really steps in. It's like the ego builds a wall between the old self, so to speak, and the new self, and says, no, I'm actually quite comfortable with the old self. I don't want to go through this transformation. And it definitely seems like that was something which was very much at work on 11:11 with your group.
Yes, and you know what? There was enough energy. There was enough of a unified field. There was some kind of a cushion. You know, it's the 26th trip. And I've seen people freaking out and seen all kinds of things go on. But there was something nurturing us and protecting us. And I'm going to go as far as to say, particularly on this night, Hakim on the other side, reaching his cosmic hand in and protecting us. And I could hear him talking to me. I could feel him right there. And so isn't that what it's about, to commune in the multidimensional sphere? Isn't he brilliant to have been able to leave and transfer onto the other side and yet have the wisdom of the ancient Egyptians that understand what happens when we pass, that we don't die, that he was well versed in this? I mean, to me, it was just so interdimensionally, magically comfortable that I became very calm.
It's fantastic. And, you know, I'm sorry that I didn't get to meet Hakim when he was alive on this plane with us, but it sounds to me like if we travel with you, we might meet him anyway.
Well, and the other thing is that his son showed up, and I've known Joseph since he's like 14 years old, because I hung out with Hakim for years, 10 years. And his son was dutiful, and he'd come and he'd serve tea and he'd be polite and all that stuff. But he certainly didn't look particularly interested in anything that we'd spend hours and hours talking about. And so he showed up on the bus at Abusir. And then he was ready to talk about the power plant system and show things. And I'm watching him going, like, when did he take an interest in this? And I'm listening to him. And he's going way beyond what Hakim would have said and beyond what Chris Dunn has, I've heard him say. And I went up to him after and I said, Joseph, tell me, today, did you say more than you know? And he looked up at me and he's like, yes, actually. And it's been happening more and more. I said, well, you know what's happening. He said, well, I think I do. I said, well, you're channeling your father. He goes, I know, that's what I was thinking. And I said, and you're going beyond even what he knew when he was here. And we had quite the moment of wide sparkling eyes. And he's been given this gift, and all of a sudden he's all about it. So there you go.
Well, with that beautiful point, we have to go to the beyond as well, which is that we have reached the end of our show. But Carmen, it was, as for the first time, again, a wonderful delight to have you on the show. Keep us posted on anything you are doing and any news you have, and we will definitely have you back on. If you want to hear the first interview which we did with Carmen, you can do so in a number of ways. There are the BBS Radio archives at bbsradio.com. You can also download it for free from iTunes if you search for either Kathleen or my name or The Spirit Revolution. It will come up in the podcast section. If you want to listen to other interviews we have done in the past, those two places are available for you as well. And the last five interviews we always do are available from our own website, which is thespiritrevolution.com. We have reached the end of this show, but we will be back next week. Until then, from the two of us,
the truth against the world.